You're listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Here with a fresh perspective on the market, the economy, and your money. From the Spokane office of the Opus 111 Group, Mike Mayo.
Hello and welcome. Don't attempt to adjust your radio. My name is Andrew Harvey from the Seattle office of Opus 111 Group. And I'm covering money management this week for the one and only Mike Mayo, who is out on vacation. And we hope it is a wonderful vacation indeed. Thanks so much for joining us today on Money Management. We're going to be talking about a couple things, including behavioral finance and some of the major news items from around this week, and getting right into the meat of the matter. Happy end of tax season for those of you who choose to celebrate, and I think you ought to. For those of you who haven't filed an extension, of course. Congrats on making it through the slog, and continue to make sure we have money for things like fire departments, bridges, and schools, which I think we can all agree are fundamentally good things to have. Speaking of taxes and Uncle Sam, that's our first main story for today. The IRS said this week that it would once again waive the penalties for required minimum distributions from inherited IRAs for certain people who have inherited those accounts since 2020. Now that's a lot of financial terms in a single sentence, so let's take a minute and break down what it all means. An inherited IRA is an account that's set up when someone passes away and leaves their retirement account to someone as part of their estate. Now, some types of heirs, spouses, minor children, people who are permanently disabled, and some types of trusts are allowed to keep these accounts for a very long period of time, which is desirable because you don't pay capital gains or income tax on the funds in an IRA as they're growing. Everyone who's not in that eligible category, say for instance the adult children of the deceased, has 10 years from the year of death to completely empty the account. Essentially, the person who passed away got a tax break for it all those years ago when they were working. The government compels the heirs to take out the money, and it takes them out every single one of those 10 years on what's called a required minimum distribution, so that the money can be taxed as income, and Uncle Sam gets his cut. For instance, let's say we have someone that we'll call Susan, who inherits a $1 million IRA from her mother after she passes away. Now, under current law, Susan's required to take the required minimum distributions, which we'll call RMDs, that's what they're referred to, from that account over a period of 10 years and have it completely empty by the end of that 10 years. If she fails to take the RMD in a given year, or if there's anything left in the account after 10 years, then she gets penalized by the IRS for not following the rules. The trick is, this rule was put in place during the Secure Act of 2019, and the messaging around it was muddy, to say the least. As a result, the IRS has acknowledged the confusion. They waived the penalty for not taking the RMDs in 2021, 22, 23, and now this week they've said they're going to waive it for 2024 as well. That penalty, by the way, is a whopping 25% of the RMD amount not taken, by the way. So you don't want to be behind the curve on getting that money withdrawn from the account. But hey, if the penalty's waived for this year, then everything's all good, right? Well, the trick is that 10-year window is still ticking under the current guidance issued by the IRS. That means even though you won't get a penalty this year if you don't take the money out, you might be sticking yourself with a really big tax bill in the future if you leave it till late in that 10-year period to get to work on the withdrawals, which again are all taxable as income to you. Coming back to Susan, for instance, let's say she inherited that IRA in 2021. Now she got started on those RMDs right away, and for the sake of the example, if that $1 million didn't grow at all, she could take out $100,000 every year of those 10 years, pay the taxes on that income, and then be free and clear within the time limit with no penalties. If she hasn't taken RMDs in those first 4 years, then all of a sudden she's looking at having to take over $165,000 out every year of the last 6 years to avoid paying penalties for missing the 10-year window. If Susan leaves it too late and has to take out the whole million at the end of the 10 years, she'll have missed the chance to balance out the tax hit and will be giving a big chunk of her inheritance right back to the government in the form of income tax. That said, maybe Susan is close to retirement herself and is in a high income tax bracket right now. So maybe it makes sense to defer those first 4 years of income and not take the RMDs since she's not being penalized, and wait until she's in a lower tax bracket in retirement to help make those withdrawals. That sort of planning is something that we do with clients all the time at Opus 111 Group to try to figure out the system of withdrawals that will work best for their needs while trying to mitigate any potentially surprising tax bills. In other news, athletic apparel company Lululemon announced Friday that the company would be shutting down its Washington distribution center and moving to a larger warehouse in the Los Angeles area. The retailer filed a WARN notice stating that it intended to lay off 128 employees at its distribution center in Sumner, Washington. The company also confirmed that it would be shutting down its store in Seattle's Pacific Place shopping mall on April 21st last week. Lululemon saw surging growth the past few years, tripling its warehouse footprint since 2021. The company had $1.6 billion in sales in 2013 and reported $9.6 billion last year. Still, sales for the retail giant have slowed somewhat in the Americas, their top market, growing sales by 9% in the 3 months ending January 28th, compared to 29% over that same span 1 year prior. Those are the headlines. Let's take a look now at some of this week's key numbers. Bit of a down week for the S&P 500 this week. It slipped just over a point and a half on Monday and just under a point and a half on Tuesday before steadily trickling down the remainder of the week. It closed down about 9-tenths of 1 percentage point there on Friday to close out the week at 49.67. That's the first close under 5,000 since February 21st of this year. On the whole, the index declined about 3.5% on the week. Still, though, the S&P is up on the year, about 4.14% all told. It's got a one-year trail of just over 20% currently. Dow closed the week at 37,986. It's up about 12.5% from this time in 2023. NASDAQ also slipped on Friday, but is still up nearly 33% from 1 year ago. Russell 2000 closed at 1947. It's down a little bit so far here in 2023, but it is up about 8.8% from this time 1 year ago. The FTSE over in the United Kingdom closed at 78.95. That's just about flat on the one-year trail. Not much movement there. A little bit of movement, about 2.25% so far here in 2024. The Nikkei Index in Japan closed at 37,068.35. That is up about 10.75% so far this year, and about 30% from this time last year. Crude oil, having a bit of a bump so far this year. It's up to 83.24 as of Friday's figures. It closed 2023 at about 71.65 a barrel. Gold also on a big tear right now. It's up to 24.06. Closed last year at 2062. So that's about a 20% jump so far for gold, as we're seeing commodities going on a bit of a run right now. Most of the other big movement on Friday had to do with microchips and the companies that make them. NVIDIA dropped 10% on Friday alone. That was its worst single day since March of 2020. Of course, the price is still up about 181% from this time 1 year ago. Supermicro Computer, one of the companies that builds NVIDIA-based servers, saw its shares drop 23% Friday after the company said it would report its earnings later this month. Ordinarily, in the past, they have been providing preliminary results ahead of earnings calls. All told, the VanEck Index that tracks the production of microchips fell 4.5% on Friday. And ARM, a company that sells intellectual property for chips, sort of complementary to NVIDIA and processor-based AI servers, fell 17%. AMD, which is NVIDIA's primary GPU competitor, fell about 5% on the day. Once again, thanks for listening this week. I'm Andrew Harvey from the Seattle office of Opus 111 Group, filling in for your regular host, Mike Mayle. For this segment, I want to get into the main topic of what we're covering this week, behavioral finance. Now, as a quick overview, behavioral finance basically attempts to study the ways in which the human brain affects the way investors make decisions. If you happen to be wondering, usually the brain causes us to make suboptimal decisions. This makes sense. We're human beings. You know, our brains are still trained to think and deal with the potential that there are tigers in the long grass. And as a result, there are a number of cognitive and emotional biases that can infect investors and lead to those suboptimal decisions that can really screw up a portfolio. Behavioral finance emerged as an evolution of the modern portfolio theory that was established back in the 1950s. That theory changed a lot of thinking around finance at the time, but they usually relied on a few key underpinnings, one of which was that investors make rational decisions or are capable of doing so. Unfortunately, you and I know that's not true because of the hunk of meat in our heads that often keeps us up late at night wondering about the future. Going with your gut can make a lot of sense in situations where you might be in danger, but it can cause you to trip over your own feet in the financial sphere. The mental traps we set for ourselves can really set us up for failure if we don't take steps to catch ourselves when we're committing them. Here's a couple cognitive biases that we work to educate clients about so we can work through them together when they pop up. Anchoring's fixating on a specific price for something. Let's say you bought a share of the XYZ company for $100 and then it went up to $110. Now, 10% return is nothing to sneeze at, and as Bernard Baruch once said, no one ever went broke taking a profit. Still, maybe the stock jumped up really quickly and you think that there's more room for it to grow. So you start telling yourself, well, I'm not selling my XYZ until it hits $120. Then you're anchoring. Right? By fixating on a specific price you want to sell for, you're missing out on the potential to say at, say, 117, or even right now at 110. You know that old saying, don't let perfect be the enemy of done. If something has the right value to fund what you need it to do, including reinvesting it somewhere else, then try not to get too fixated on the precise numbers. By the way, we say anchoring in trading data all the time. Share prices often get a little bit sticky around whole dollar numbers because suddenly people are willing to buy XYZ at $100 per share but weren't interested at, say, $100.23. Hindsight bias is basically how everything seems obvious that it was going to happen after it happened. I was a history major in college, and the word we had for it was retrospective determinism. Essentially, what was always meant to be. That can feel like the case, but it's just not true. There's a million different ways that things can always play out in any situation. Look at Sears, for example, right? Longtime household name in the American retail space went bankrupt in 2018 after having had a share price of over $150 a share in 2007. It seems obvious today that Sears was always going to crater and brick-and-mortar retail was going to go the way of the dodo, but who's to say there's not a universe where Sears did a better job of reading the room and pivoted toward online retail earlier in the e-commerce era? It's important to think about and confront prior mistakes, but you can't get too fixated on what's happened because you still have road in front of you. Hindsight bias is trying to drive forward while looking in the rearview mirror. Don't do that. Recency bias pairs pretty closely with hindsight bias. It's when you start thinking that because something has been hot lately, it's going to stay that way. They often call it the hot hand fallacy in basketball, where if Caitlin Clark is nailing all her shots, you should keep feeding her and her alone the ball because she's, quote, on a hot streak, unquote. Gamblers fall into this one all the time. Probability doesn't care much about narrative, and it definitely doesn't care about what's happened in previous iterations of an exercise, but people still pile into investments that have been on a tear, hoping to keep riding the rising tide. As for what actually happens, it's usually a pretty great way to wind up buying high and selling low, which is not the winning formula that we're looking for. Last one I want to talk about is confirmation bias. We run into confirmation bias in everything in our lives, not just finance. Confirmation bias is when you tune out information that doesn't support your existing worldview, or you only seek out information that does match what you already think. This is a really tough one to work through. As humans, we like to feel like we're right about things, especially that we made good decisions. Trying to face the prospect that maybe we made a bad decision makes us deeply uncomfortable, so we tend to tune out the bad news and only focus on the good. Of course, this means we may hold on to something for longer than we should, even as it declines in value, because we're surrounding ourselves with information that our investment is, quote, you know, about to turn the corner. The best way to deal with confirmation bias is to force yourself to interact with sources that contradict what you want to be true, and do some digging to see if they hold any weight. Working with an advisor can be especially important for this one, as long as that advisor engages with their own confirmation bias, and everyone's got it. At Opus, we strive to combat our biases all the time. It's hard, but it's what we need to do a good job for our clients, which makes it worth it. You may also be less than stunned to learn that social media has cranked all of the behavioral biases in the investing world and everywhere else up to 11. Our feeds provide us information 24/7 that want us to keep using their platform because that's how they get paid. So they cater to your tastes and algorithmically tee up information that you want to see and feel good consuming. It also creates a sense of community, and if you feel like you're among your peers and a part of the group where you belong, you may feel inclined to go with the group's prevailing view on certain things, including different types of investments, even if they may not be right for you or may not be a good idea at all. This can affect everyone, even the pros. I was reading an article from the Investments and Wealth Institute the other day that 4 out of 5 institutional investors frequently use social media at work. A third of the 250 people polled for a study said that social media and the information they consume regularly influences their investment decisions. So if a third of people are willing to admit that on the poll, what do you think the real number might be for how much social media is actually influencing their investments? The end result is that people who are savvy with social media and know how to play that game get to steer the investment conversation in the direction that suits them best. You've probably seen articles of, you know, the X number of investment strategies you're missing out on, or the, you know, the wealth technique that you don't know about. Headlines that are designed to make you feel like you're already making a mistake by not doing things their way. So you click on the article, read about their thing, start to feel good about it, the biases start to take over, and you start making decisions that aren't right for you or your portfolio. But again, right, we are all dealing with the human brain that is in our skulls and trying to make the best of it. So how do you deal with all of this? Well, the first thing is to try not to let yourself spend too much time worrying, and especially not losing sleep, about what folks on social media are saying you should do with your money. Working with an advisor can help with that if you have a relationship built on mutual trust and understanding of your values around money. Your advisor can help talk you off the ledge and stay on target when that pesky brain is trying to play tricks on you. In our last segment of the show today, we're also going to spend a little more time talking about what you can do to confront and try to conquer as best as possible some more of these biases. But for right now, it is time for us to take another break here on Money Management. For our next segment, I'm going to turn things over to the president of Opus 111 Group, Jim Harvey. He's going to talk about why your portfolio's return looks different than the headlines you hear about on Wall Street.
In this segment, I want to go over a question that everybody naturally asks themselves, and I want to explain why I don't think you should bother. And that has to do with looking at your portfolio and wondering, well, why doesn't my portfolio keep track with some stock market index like the S&P 500 or the Russell 3000, et cetera, et cetera? And this is a really good question. I mean, it's completely normal and understandable to ask that question. But when you delve into it a little bit more, it's the kind of wrong question to ask. And this is why I wrote a white paper several years ago explaining this in great detail. So if you would like a copy of that, please send us an email at info@opus111group.com, and we will get back to you with a copy of this white paper that I wrote in 2019. You know, I've been in the business 41 years, and I realized that this question is a very important question that clients have asked, and we haven't really done, as an industry, a good job of answering. Now, there are a number of reasons why your portfolio wouldn't track the S&P 500, for example. One of the most profound differences is something to do with how performance is reported by indices and managers and ETF managers, mutual fund managers, institutional separate account managers track performance, and how we report performance to you on our various reports or just by looking at your statement month after month. And that has to do with the difference between time-weighted and dollar-weighted return. So understanding the difference between these two different methodologies is important. Now, you know, you'd like the answer to this be simple. Unfortunately, like a lot of things in life, a complete and comprehensive answer is far more nuanced. You know, I've been a guest lecturer at Stanford University for 25 years. And one of the things that you think about is, okay, what are some of the differences for that? But let's take with a time-weighted and dollar-weighted return basis. And this white paper I referred to really goes into great depth and shows you how these things are different. But the basic difference is that index, for example, reports the performance of the index in its entirety, but it does not take into account when people put money in and when people take money out. And it makes sense that they just look at, you know, the performance of the stocks in the index over a period of time, and what did it do from point A to point B? And that could be a month, it could be a quarter, it could be a year, it could be 5 years. But none of those things really have anything to do with the investment decisions of investors. And that makes sense, because when you think about it, you wouldn't want the performance of an index or a manager, for example, which is also tracked the same way, or a mutual fund or an ETF, either unfairly aided by or unfairly punished by the investment decisions of their investors. Now, for example, one of the things that we do when we vet an institutional separate account manager is we ask them, have you lost any major accounts recently? So let's say you're a manager with, you know, that manages $1 billion, but they had a $200 million account leave. Well, obviously that's going to have a material effect on their performance. And it would be unfair for us to penalize them because, you know, some defined benefit pension plan in the state of California decided, okay, we're out of here. So that makes sense. That's why time-weighted return is the way it is. That's the return that you might see when you see it on the news or on the internet or that kind of thing. However, what clients want to know is, how did I do? And that's called dollar-weighted return, or another word for that, and you've probably seen this, is internal rate of return. Now, that one really affects the performance that you actually get, and that's what you want to know. You don't want to know what some abstract either manager's return is or the index. You want to know, I put this money in, it's worth X now, how did I do? And that's what dollar-weighted or internal rate of return does. Now, besides this fundamental difference between how managers and indices report performance, has to do with something that we've seen over the years with our clients. And that is, clients tend to forget why they pull money out of their portfolios. And if you pull money out, for example, when the market is down, that's going to have an effect on the overall performance of your portfolio. And you'll see it on your monthly statements, and you'll see it on the reports that we generate for you that are internal rate of return reports. But why do people take money out? Well, for all kinds of very good reasons, none of which are designed to maximize your portfolio's performance. Examples are, oh, I need to buy a new house or a vacation home, or I'm about ready to retire and I want to buy an RV, or you might have to pay, you know, tuition to a private school for your kids to go to high school or college or graduate school. You may have to take a required minimum distribution from your IRA or an annuity. All of those decisions have a lot to do with what the money that we invest for you is designed to do, which is to help you live your life and help your family. And none of those, really, the primary reason for that is, you know, to manage your life, but it isn't to design the best portfolio performance over time. So here are some examples of the kinds of things that we've had clients take money out, and that, you know, I would encourage you to think about in your own life in terms of what, you know, what you want your money to do. So for example, to meet living expenses, I got to eat. To repair a roof or remodel a kitchen or a bathroom, or put money down to buy a house or pay off your mortgage, or, as I mentioned before, pay private school or college tuition, to pay off a student or another loan, to buy a new car or a truck, to invest in a business or a real estate opportunity. Here's one: to pay your income, real estate, or other taxes. I mean, all of these things have to do with living your life, and none of them have to do with maximizing your portfolio's performance. And yet clients tend to forget that. So when you're looking at these kinds of things, just remember that our job is to provide you with the money to live the life that you deserve and envision. Other examples are capturing tax losses to minimize income taxes, or to buy a boat or a mortgage slip, or to pay for your daughter or son's wedding, or take a vacation. And sometimes, you know, money coming in is you received an inheritance, et cetera, et cetera. So, or helping a parent, you know, with a deposit to a retirement home or facility. So my basic point here is that there's a lot of reasons why your portfolio's performance and what you see on your monthly statements doesn't necessarily match the performance of the S&P over a given period of time. Another profound difference, and this is massive, has to do with whether the stock market index, in this case the S&P, is including or presuming that dividends are reinvested, that the dividends of the stocks in the index are being reinvested in the index. And that's a very common thing for people to have as their assumptions. It isn't necessarily what people do with their actual portfolios, that we like dividends reinvestment, but it has an enormous difference and effect. A number of years ago, we looked at the hypothetical investment in American funds, which has been around, the Investment Company of America, been around since 1934. And the investment of $10,000 in 1934 would grow to, say, $2.6 million. This is through 2017, and we can get you the most recent figures. Grew to $2.6 million, which is a return of about 7%. But with dividends reinvested instead of $2 million, it grew to $60 million. And that's just the S&P. So the point is that dividends reinvestment is another reason why, when you look at those figures, it may not be the best thing to do. Finally, and this is an important thing, stock indices were not designed to be portfolios, and an awful lot of airtime and groupthink is about, oh, you know, you should invest in the index. No, David Blitzer is the person in charge of the S&P itself, has always said that this was not designed to be a portfolio. And yet so many people are saying, just give me the portfolio return, just give me the index return. And that's a very simple answer, but the problem is there's a lot of risk associated with that index that I don't think you want, and most of our clients are not comfortable with.
And before we wrap things up, I wanted to talk a little bit more about behavioral finance. Now, in our second segment on this week's show, we talked about some of the common cognitive biases that affect all of us, from first-time investors to seasoned pros. These biases put us in feedback loops that lead us to make decisions that can negatively impact our portfolios. So we've got to work to overcome them if our invested assets are going to grow the way they need to in order to meet our goals. Now, before we go any further, I want to reiterate that part about those biases affecting all of us. There's nothing wrong with being subject to these behavioral biases. It's part of the way our brains help us sort through problems and help us survive. The issue arises if we don't take any steps to counteract these biases when we're dealing with investments. So how do we try to overcome these biases? The first thing you can do is educate yourself about them. There's a really great book out there from Nobel Prize-winning psychologist and economist Daniel Kahneman, who sadly passed away last month. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's a really great primer for learning more about how the human brain functions and how we process information and try to make decisions. You can also work to find online quizzes that help you identify what sort of investor you are based on your personality, which can help you figure out which biases you're most likely to be susceptible to. It also makes a lot of sense to develop a financial plan. When we engage with planning for our clients, we start by working to understand their values around money before we get to their goals. Those goals help us all remember what we're aiming for long term and give us concrete metrics to evaluate against to see if we're on pace to fulfill those goals. Now, education and planning are the easy part of it. It's the doing that's the trick. If you're going to try and go it alone, I think it's important to look at and evaluate your performance in selecting investments. Your successes, yes, but your failures even more so. When you're looking at your failures, you have to ask yourself, all right, what went wrong? Why did you believe something was going to be a good investment? What criteria did you use to arrive at that decision? And how did it go after that? Did you keep notes of times when you were tempted to sell? What about times you were scared to sell? Scheduling regular check-ins like this with yourself and keeping detailed notes, or even a journal, about your thought process can help you start to understand how you engage with investing, and even help steer you toward making logic-based decisions instead of intuitive ones, which are the ones that are subject to those biases. You have to challenge the wisdom of the crowd. Resist putting something in your portfolio just because everybody knows you do X to build a portfolio. It's not how you wind up with an investment portfolio that's suited for your needs. When you're examining potential selections for your portfolio, you want to pay attention to analysis rather than stories. We have a strong bias toward narrative understanding in our brains. We like to think of things in terms of stories because they're easier to understand than volumes and volumes of data about a company's financial health, or the trading patterns behind its stock. The issue with stories, though, is that it can cause us to overlook the reality of a situation hidden in the footnotes. This ties in with falling in love with your investments. You'll put all this time and energy into making a pick and then hold it for a long period, probably. And since you're now a part owner of the company, at least in the case with equities, you may start to feel an affinity for the company, especially if it provides you large returns. The trick is, though, you still need to have developed a plan for how you're going to exit that position. It's the money you're after in the long term, not the shares. The next thing you can do is make a system and stick to it. You have to use whatever your framework for selecting investments is to put together your portfolio, but then you have to consistently confront emotional concerns about what the market's going to do on any given day. I'm sure you've been out before with people and someone will say, "Oh, the news of XYZ, I pulled all my money out of the market." It's a common sentiment. We perceive a high level of risk, so we try to eliminate that risk by moving to so-called safe places to keep our money. There are a number of issues with that, but it's also important to point out that the data doesn't bear out that hypothesis. To date, equity markets in the United States have never failed to recover from downturns. It can take a while, but they've always bounced back. Even if you do pull all your money, how are you going to know when to get back in? Consider, too, the risks of the so-called safe places to keep money. It's true that money in a bank account or in a certificate of deposit is at an extremely low risk of loss, depending on the size of the funds, thanks to the FDIC. But what about the risk of long-term underperformance? The risk that your assets won't grow large enough over the long term to support your retirement or your other financial goals. That's a critical risk too, and it's one all too often confronted by risk-averse investors who aren't willing to get into the market. Instead, we should think about coming up with a budget and allocating the resources you can afford to put into the market on a consistent basis. This allows you to achieve what's called dollar cost averaging. Basically, averaging out the amount you pay for your portfolio as the market rises or falls. More importantly, it gets you in the habit of consistently adding money to your portfolio so it can grow over time to meet your goals. This can also require a tremendous amount of discipline. I always joke with clients that, you know, spending habits are like pouring water into a jar. It'll take whatever shape you put it in. If you don't pay yourself first by putting money into your portfolio, there's a good chance you'll wind up spending it all before you get a chance to do so. Coming up with a disciplined investment plan is critical to make sure you stick to the plan you've created and keep moving forward toward your goals. Of course, if this all sounds daunting, remember that you don't have to go it alone. Working with an advisor with whom you can develop a relationship of mutual trust and respect can go a long way toward mitigating these tricky behavioral traps that affect all of us. The advisor who's right for you will help you work through the times when you're letting mental biases get in the way of sticking to your plan and getting you where you want and need to go. I hope you found our information about behavioral finance interesting this week. It's one of the areas of this work that I find most fascinating. So I was glad to get a chance to come on the air and talk about it. Again, that book recommendation from earlier this segment is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. I hope you'll consider adding it to your reading list. And if you're interested in learning more about behavioral finance or how we use it to help our clients, I hope you'll reach out to us at info@opus111group.com. That's info@opus111group.com. That's going to do it for this week. Mike Mail will return with a new expanded version of money management starting next Saturday with even more financial common sense than ever before, his words. Again, my name is Andrew Harvey. I'm with the Seattle branch of Opus 111 Group, and I wish you a great rest of your weekend.
Join us again next week at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of money management with Mike Mail, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Have a question, comment, or want to find out if you'd be a good fit with Opus 111? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investment involves risk and is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.